Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Carl Zimmer, multi-award-winning science writer and columnist for the New York Times, whose most recent book was selected by Publishers Weekly as one of the 10 best for 2018. She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potentials of Heredity, where he examines the scientific revolution underway with genomics and how to harness this emerging science to not only understand our origins, but also advance our health. Lori Robertson also checks in. Managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Carl Zimmer, science columnist and author of numerous books, including his latest, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potentials of Heredity, which has been selected as one of the top 10 books for 2018 by Publishers Weekly. Mr. Zimmer has written on science topics for the New York Times since 2004, including the popular column Matter. Prior to joining the Times, he was a science writer and senior editor at Discover and has written for numerous other publications, including the National Geographic, Wired, The Atlantic, Time, and Stat. He is an adjunct professor in the School of Biophysics and Biochemistry at Yale. Mr. Zimmer has won numerous awards, including a three-time winner of the American Association for the Advancement of Science Journalism Award and the National Academy's Science Communication Award. Carl, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, you've written extensively about the world of science for a couple of decades with a focus on evolutionary science, genomics, and DNA. And in your most recent book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, you examine this explosion of knowledge that's underway and our fundamental understanding of the impact of DNA on heredity and how we're learning so much from the genomics world. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners how some of those more recent scientific breakthroughs are revolutionizing our thinking about heredity and why this shift compelled you to write this book.
Yeah, it's been kind of astonishing to see how much things have changed, really, even in just the past few years. You know, when I started out in the 1990s as a journalist, the idea of sequencing one human genome was now it's possible to sequence a human genome for maybe $1,000. It's probably going to drop down to a few hundred. And, you know, you can do what's called genotyping from a place like 23andMe for maybe $100. And so all of a sudden, we're just swimming in data about our genes. And so scientists can really look gene by gene, mutation by mutation, at exactly how we inherit genes from our ancestors. And in some ways, it's really challenging a lot of our kind of, you know, traditional notions. And we're even finding, you know, other kinds of heredity. You know, you can find, for example, that, you know, you can inherit your genes from more than one person. Many people are actually chimeras, where their bodies are made up of a mixture of cells from different individuals. It might be a twin, and those cells are traded before birth. Mothers can actually absorb fetal cells, which actually become incorporated into their bodies. So they don't just have their children in their thoughts, they have their children's cells in their brain. And so, you know, heredity is just becoming a lot more interesting now.
Well, it is fascinating indeed. And you say so clearly that the accessibility of the information with the price of personal genomic testing coming way down, as you said, through entities like Ancestry.com or 23andMe and others. But you also talk about your own experience of having your whole genome sequenced and say that it led to more questions than answers in your case. So share with us what you learned from that experience, but also what sort of recommendations and cautions you would offer to people who are interested in gaining access to their own genomic profiles.
When you go to a company like 23andMe or Ancestry, what they do is something called genotyping, where basically they look at about 1,000 of the genetic letters in your DNA. That's kind of a high-level survey of the kinds of genetic variants that you have. But if you want to really get the full picture, you do something what's called whole genome sequencing. That's not really a consumer product yet. There are a couple companies that can make it available, but it's hard to actually get your hands on the data. And so I, through various tricks and twists that I talk about in my book, was able to actually get hold of my whole genome. One day, an external hard drive with 60 gigabits of data shows up on my front doorstep, and I've got it, and it's amazing. But of course, you know, if I plug that into my computer and decrypt it, what I'm looking at is a gigantic spreadsheet, which means nothing to me. So what I did was then went to different scientists who have different areas of expertise and said, you study genomes. What can you see in my genome? Show me how you do your science using my genome as an example. And I would say that I'm not particularly unusual when it comes to my genome, but it is fascinating to really dig into a big piece of DNA that is yours. And yet, there are a lot of questions that you end up asking, maybe more questions than answers.
You know, you launched a very interesting series of partnerships with the online health publication STAT. You called it Game of Genomes, catchy title, in which you, as you said to us, you know, here, take my petri dish of data and explore it to this whole group of scientists. You shared that process in an award-winning series that helped explain more fully your specific genomic traits in. Tell us what perhaps the public needs to understand about genetic research and also its implications in their lives.
So it can be an amazing experience to get any look at your DNA, but you have to recognize that, you know, the science is very young. It's not like there's like some complete catalog of revealed truth that's just waiting for you. Scientists are just starting to figure this stuff out. So for one thing, what you have to understand is that a lot of this research takes a huge amount of time. Just going through the 3 billion or so base pairs in one person's DNA is a gigantic labor. So for example, you know, I have roughly 1.5% Neanderthal DNA. And I was actually able to look at a complete catalog of my Neanderthal genes, which was fascinating. But then, you know, the next thing I do is I say, okay, well, that gene, what does that gene do? Well, nobody knows. Mm-hmm. So I say, okay, well, can you tell me anything about how these Neanderthal variants affect me? And if you're curious about what are the Neanderthal genes that are sprinkled throughout your chromosomes, these are programs that these scientists are using on their computers that they wrote themselves and are just sort of like hacking together. So there's not some great big government computer where all this data comes out of. So it turns out that there are a lot of mutations that you can find in your genome where scientists can say, well, if I look at that mutation, I have a pretty good feeling that that is going to actually have a real change to one of your proteins. But I don't know if that's harmless. It could be even beneficial, but we don't know. So there are certain mutations that are very strongly linked to certain diseases, and then there's a gigantic twilight zone trying to shine a light into.
Well, Carl, one thing that really is maybe the most fascinating to me is that the more that you've researched this topic, the more you've discovered that nurture seems to have a powerful impact on gene expression and heredity, or has as much of an impact as the genome itself. You know, we've had some guests on the show, Mark, talking about this topic. I remember Dr. Donald Warren at the University of North Dakota talking so compellingly about the epigenetic impact of cultural trauma on Native American people and how that's affected multiple generations. And then we had Stanford's Dr. Raj Chetty on the show discussing his research on, you know, geography and place, how one zip code impacts health outcomes, maybe more than the individual's genetic code. You've been analyzing this nature versus nurture paradox as well. Tell us what you've learned and kind of what insights and conclusions you have about this.
We've been trying to think about nature and nurture for a long, long time. I mean, actually, Shakespeare uses those words in one of his plays. So this isn't something that's new to modern science. But what is new is that we can really tease apart these different contributions. We can say, well, you know, just how much does it matter where you are born geographically in terms of, you know, the social conditions that you are experiencing? How much does depend on particular genes that you inherit? And so certainly, like, geneticists who cannot blind themselves to the power of these social factors. But, you know, the flip side is also true that some of the responses that people will have to different environments, you know, if people are in a very hard, challenging environment growing up, why is it that some people are resilient and some are not? There may be an answer in the different genes that people carry. And, you know, and there isn't any sort of clean line that you can divide, really, between nature and nurture, because the way your genes work often is controlled by the environment. And likewise, you know, your genes may actually cause you to seek out different environments to shape the environment around you. So we can't think about it as sort of an either-or thing.
We're speaking today with Carl Zimmer, multiple award-winning science writer and author of numerous books, including his latest, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potentials of Heredity. Mr. Zimmer has written on science topics for the New York Times since 2004, including the popular column Matter. Carl, I can't help but think that if we're having a conversation about genome, that we don't want to talk about what I think every school child knows now, which is CRISPR technology, or at least is hearing about it and its impact on our sort of general landscape. And I'm wondering what your thoughts about this type of gene editing process that has a wide variety of applications, including use in some basic biology research tools and the development of biotechnology products. How do you think that's going to change or revolutionize how we think about curing diseases and you know, our sort of own mortality?
What I'm most excited by are some trials that are actually starting literally right now, where scientists want to use this technology for editing DNA to treat, maybe even cure, inherited diseases that until now have had no good treatment at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sickle cell anemia is
right.
A case in point.
Right.
Hard disease. It's an inherited disease. It's the result of mutations in genes for hemoglobin. And, you know, there are treatments that people can get that can extend their lives. But still today, you know, people are living into their 40s and 50s at most on average. And it's, you know, it's, and there's a, and these diseases cause a huge amount of pain and suffering along the way.
And it's a single gene mutation, right? Sickle cell.
That's right. So if you have a mutation on both copies of this gene, you're going to get this disease. And so what scientists are exploring now in a clinical trial is using this technology, CRISPR, to create molecules that can go into cells and can cut out a little piece of DNA, sort of alter that tiny little bit of DNA very precisely. And what's going to happen is that these cells are going to be able to start making healthy hemoglobin again because their DNA has been altered. Now, it's a completely open question whether this is going to work or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are the devils in the details and these sorts of things, but these clinical trials are starting. Lots of experiments on mice with diseases like muscular dystrophy and so on suggest that this could work. So I think this is a really potentially revolutionary treatment. Now, what gets people really riled up is not what I just talked about. What gets people riled up is the idea of using this on human embryos. Because if you do that, then that person who develops from that embryo is going to have that engineering in every one of their cells and will pass that down to future generations. I think that's a separate discussion that we do need to have. I think that, you know, what you've seen from a lot of ethicists and scientists who've talked about this is, you know, we really should not even be talking about this kind of procedure except for things for which there's no other alternative. And that actually rules out all sorts of stuff. It would really only be an incredibly rare set of circumstances where you could medically justify this sort of approach on embryos. That being said, I'm sure there would be some parents who would love to use it to make their kids taller, to change their appearance, to give them genes that have, they've been told will make their kids more successful. So we really have to withstand that seduction.
Well, Carl, that's in, I think, many ways a great segue into the next question that I was really interested in hearing your thoughts on, and that is, given this just phenomenal, world-changing set of tools at and soon to be increasingly at our disposal, what's the best way to think about getting ready to teach and prepare the next generation of clinicians in healthcare so they're ready to adapt to all of this evolving scientific discovery that's going to lead to better ways to treat and manage and diagnose, maybe even prevent the onset of disease, and do it through ways that are not in our toolbox at all right now? You've written some important textbooks in science education. What do you think about preparing our clinical workforce for the future, which increasingly in our health and healthcare is going to be moving more towards genomics-based personalized medicine?
I do think that clinicians just really have to practically start over with their education because so much has changed so quickly. And the patients are going to be coming to doctors with results they're getting from direct-to-consumer services as customers. And they're going to say, look, 23andMe says I have this. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, they already are.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you need to learn how to talk about, for example, risk. You know, what does it mean to have a variant that raises your risk of a disease? There's a big difference between a mutation that guarantees you're going to get Huntington's disease and a mutation that slightly, on average, increases the risk of heart disease. And yet it's hard for people to recognize it. If it's there on the report, they think it's all the same. At the same time, I think that clinicians are going to have to really get to understand lots of very common diseases are influenced by hundreds or thousands of different genes. And that can sound like a nightmare if you're trying to look at each and every gene. But, you know, there are these approaches known as polygenic risk scores that are going to be coming more and more into practice, where you'll sequence a patient's whole genome and then come up with a score, which then translates to a real different kind of risk depending on what category you're in. And actually, with heart disease, this has already been demonstrated pretty effectively in just some recent papers from Harvard Medical School. So what scientists are starting to do is develop a way to look across the entire genome at lots and lots of different variants and figure out how do they add up in each person to a risk for a particular disease. And so you just basically get a number. And scientists at Harvard Medical School have been pioneering this with heart disease. And, you know, their scores are pretty impressive now. If you divide people up, they have very different risk profiles, and these scores do a good job of predicting how many people in each category are going to get a heart attack or not. So this stuff is coming really fast, and it's going to be a communication challenge, and it's also going to be just a learning challenge. You know, that high school genetics that began and ended with Mendel's peas is just not going to be good enough.
You know, it's interesting that on one hand, you have a group of people who are coming forward with questions to, as you said before, your provider, how can you address this problem that's been identified? And I think your book sort of talks about this hopeful promise, but also this cautionary tale about science and how it could be misused and advance certain agendas. And then on the other side of the equation, you've got people who are talking about anti-vaxxers, the climate change deniers, or those who misuse science to advance their own political agenda. Just sort of a larger question of what is it going to take to bring science back to its proper place in our political discourse with these extremes? We have extremes in science, we have extreme in politics and the like, but I think you understand the fundamentals of science are important for, you know, this in some ways should be a settled matter that we have some faith and trust in science, and yet it seems that we have extremes as well. Thoughts about that?
Well, you know, certainly within medicine and beyond, pretty much every major improvement in human welfare has had something to do with scientific research and discovering things through science. And it would be tragic for us. I do think that people do have a great respect still for scientists and for doctors and so on, but there are these certain areas where people will want to reject the findings of science because it somehow feels like a challenge to how they identify themselves or the way they look at the world. And, you know, I think we all have to sort of recognize our own biases and to learn how the scientific process actually works and how we learn about ourselves and the world and how science is an ongoing process. I think that in that way we can make sure that with genetics, for example, that it doesn't end up being used for justifying racism or other really noxious kinds of ideologies. It's happened in the past, and unfortunately, some scientists themselves have been part of the problem. And so I think we have to be very clear in terms of education and in just our own experiences and conversations to recognize what science really is and the benefits that it can give us.
We've been speaking today with Carl Zimmer, multiple award-winning science writer, longtime columnist for the New York Times, and the author of She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potentials of Heredity, which was just selected as one of Publishers Weekly's Best 10 Books for 2018. You can learn more about his work by going to his website, carlzimmer.com, or follow him on Twitter at Carl Zimmer. Carl, thank you so much for your prolific body of work, for sharing your rich insights and making it understandable to the general population, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In several of his midterm campaign rallies, President Donald Trump has made false and unsupported claims about the Right to Try law he signed on May 30th. He claims that until he signed the law, quote, we couldn't even come close, end quote, to letting terminally ill patients use promising but unapproved medications. In fact, the FDA for years has approved applications from patients seeking access to investigational drugs. Trump also claims there have been tremendous and incredible results already under the months-old federal law, but we could find no evidence that any drug manufacturers have granted access to any medications under the new law. The president made these claims in Texas, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky. The Right to Try legislation aims to circumvent the FDA and give terminally ill patients access to unapproved drugs more quickly than through the FDA's expanded access program. But FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb testified to Congress in October 2017 that the FDA had approved 99% of the more than 1,000 annual applications it gets for such access. Under either the FDA's expanded access program or the new federal Right to Try law, patients, along with their physicians, can request access to drugs that haven't yet been approved by the FDA directly from manufacturers if there are no comparable treatments. In the FDA's program, if a manufacturer agrees to make the drug or device available, both the FDA and the medical institution's institutional review board must approve a treatment protocol. Under Right to Try, which applies only to drugs, there's no FDA or IRB oversight. In both processes, the drug manufacturer decides whether or not it wants to make the drug available. The Right to Try law is nearly 5 months old, which isn't a lot of time to see incredible results, as the president claims. We asked the FDA, the Goldwater Institute, and an expert on pre-approval access to treatments whether any drug companies have granted access to drugs under the new law. They knew of no such instances. Allison Bateman House, co-chair of the NYU School of Medicine Working Group on Compassionate Use and Pre-Approval Access, told us she is active in talking with patient groups and pharmaceutical companies, and she is, quote, not aware of anyone getting access. The Goldwater Institute, a libertarian group that has pushed for state and federal right to try laws, said in a statement, quote, we are now seeing growing interest and enthusiasm from manufacturers and the medical community around right to try, but it knew of no announcement of drug access. We asked the White House press office about the president's claim, but did not receive a response. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Healthcare providers are forever on the lookout for that magic elixir that can cure a host of chronic ills in one step. And in the case of obesity, depression, anxiety, and stress, that elixir could be, turns out, a number of steps, as in taking a hike. A large study conducted by several institutions, including the University of Michigan and Edge Hill University in the UK, looked at the medicinal benefits derived from regular group hikes conducted in nature.
This study had enough people in it and following them over time that we could see that these two different types of help for our mental well-being, they're operating independently. That means that if we go out in nature for a walk, we're getting an additional boost to our mental well-being.
Researchers evaluated some 2,000 participants in a program called Walking for Health in England, which sponsors some 3,000 walks per week across the country.
You know, this is a national study in the UK. There was investment in these walking groups, in training leaders to take people on walks, finding trails that were good for people to do, even if they had health problems.
Dr. Sarah Warber, professor of family medicine at the University of Michigan School of Medicine, said this study showed a dramatic improvement in the mental well-being of participants, especially those who had recently experienced something stressful, like the loss of a loved one or a serious illness.
Depression was reduced. Perceived stress was reduced, and certainly relates to most of our lives. And that people had, they experienced more positive feelings or positive emotions. And there's been really lovely research that's shown that when we have positive emotions, we actually have better health in the long run. And we have less negative emotions when we're out in nature and when we're out in nature in a group. So we did have controls, and that's another thing that makes the study powerful, is that our control group were people who at one time intended to be part of walking groups, agreed to be followed, but they never took up the practice. And so we were able to match our walking group participants with people who were just basically just like them, but who didn't walk in groups. And so we could see how they differed over time.
The participants almost universally reported reduced stress and depression after participating in group nature hikes, and the effect was cumulative over time. Dr. Warber says it seems to be the combination of breathing in fresh air surrounded by nature during moderate exercise and the group dynamic adds a social benefit. Other studies have shown a link between mood and exercise, but Dr. Warber says this is the first study that revealed the added benefits of group hikes in nature and significant mitigation of depression.
Because we were really interested in whether, if you are more stressed, would you get some better benefit from being in nature? And in fact, that did pan out. So if you're going through stress, if you're having a hard time, getting out in nature with a group or with others has real benefit in reducing your stress.
Walk for Health, a simple guided group nature hike program, which incentivizes folks suffering from depression and anxiety to step into the fresh air with others, to talk out their thoughts while taking a hike, improving their mood, reducing their depression, increasing their overall health at the same time. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.